Hi everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is illustrator, graphic novelist, and filmmaker R.O. Bleckman. Despite having what he described as a rigid style with no quality whatsoever early on, he went on to create one of the most recognizable styles in all of illustration. Among other topics, we discuss how he created his, quote, squiggly line style. We chat about Maxa Nordau, his bohemian neighbor who set Bleckman on his 70-plus year creative journey. He tells us why Marie Sendak asked him for advice, what advice he has for today's illustrators, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. It's all kinds of makeshift over here. We're in the middle of packing and moving things, and I'm not even using my proper podcast equipment.
Oh my goodness, where are you moving to?
We live in Brooklyn, and I'm going to ask you about Brooklyn in a second, but we're moving to Pennsylvania.
That's quite a move.
Yes, it is.
Why? May I be personal?
You may.
What's in Pennsylvania then?
Well, we have three children, so room, space, grass, things like that.
Fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, have a good move. All right.
Thanks. So you were born October 1st, 1930 in Brooklyn.
That's correct.
Where in Brooklyn exactly?
Flatbush.
How long did you live there?
Well, it was a one-story house in Flatbush. There were, why did I say one story? It was two stories. My grandparents lived there. Mm-hmm. My father grew up in Brooklyn, so it was natural that we moved there. Interestingly, when the Second World War started, everybody in our family and our neighbors moved to Manhattan. I think my father says it was because we didn't have a ration card for gasoline. Therefore, it was difficult to get to Manhattan where they worked. I think it was just an excuse. Right. I think it was just that just as the family moved from Europe to Brooklyn, that was an upward move. And then from Brooklyn to Manhattan, that was another upward move.
Right.
So that's why the changes.
Gotcha. Where are you now?
I'm in Columbia County. Nice. And curiously, we're thinking of moving. How about that? Don't want to get into that story.
Right.
But we've got a large, wonderful property, but it's kind of a lot for me to handle at my age. Mm-hmm. Born 1930, so I'm no youngster. So,
speaking of age, so when World War II happened, you were 11. What do you remember about that? Do you remember when Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Very clearly. Oh, yeah, I remember the day.
What were you doing?
I had seen a movie that day. They died with their boots on. How about that? A war story. And then my brother and I came back from the movie house and we learned, oh my God, there's a real war going on. Mm. And you know what my brother said, who was very scientifically minded? Oh, damn it. Now I won't get my Zeiss Icon microscope from Germany. And I remember my mother slapped him hard, which was stupid and unnecessary. But he was a kid, 13 years old. Right. The war meant, oh my God, this is an inconvenience for him. I remember the war very, very, very well. Yeah.
Who came over from Europe?
My grandparents from Lithuania.
Okay.
It turns out that was a big Jewish settlement then.
Right.
And so one half of my family came from Lithuania. The other half came from Romania.
Interesting. My family is doing sort of the reverse in a way. My wife and I moved to Manhattan in 1999 in a maybe 300 square foot apartment, maybe. And then we moved to Windsor Terrace, which isn't too far from Flatbush. for a few years, had our first kid. Then we had our second two children at the same time, and then moved further out on the outskirts of Brooklyn and Bay Ridge. And now we're thinking of getting out entirely. So maybe we'll move to Europe at some point. Who knows?
Well, look into my area. I'm Columbia County. It's 2 hours north of New York. Great train connection, double train connection. We've got Amtrak and we've got Metro North. It's a great area. I love it. All right.
Tell me when the house next door to you goes on sale. We'll buy that one.
Okay. A lot of properties for sale.
Then we'll swing by and I don't know, I'll mow your lawn or something. Who knows?
Oh, you don't have to do that, but you're welcome to swing by.
Excellent. Yeah. So Ed Sorrell was quoted as saying that your mother was determined to have an artistic son and therefore obliged you. How did she oblige you?
No, my mother was not all that visual that I know of, but she was an extraordinary pianist. Extraordinary. So in that sense, I grew up in an artistic and musical family. But my uncle was something of an accomplished artist. When he would come to our home, he would always draw cartoons. The poor guy couldn't leave because we insisted, hey, we want another cartoon, Uncle Nat. So I grew up with cartoons. Mm-hmm. I once recently learned that you inherit as much from your uncle and aunt, I presume, as from your own parents. And isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Characteristics kind of jump what seems to be a natural circuit. Mm-hmm. Why did I become an artist? Because it was very visual. That I know. Mm-hmm. I didn't have much of a hand. I imagine the Ed Sorrells of the world, the Seymour Quast, the Milton Glazers, the McMullins, they always loved to draw. I didn't love to draw. It took me a long time to develop my style. It didn't happen naturally and it didn't happen quickly. My stuff was kind of rigid. The line had no quality whatsoever. And it was well into my career, which started because I was very bright. I had wonderful ideas. I was very funny. It was all kind of a compensation for the fact that my drawings weren't all that good.
Then
I decided, gee, I don't like the look of these things. And so I quite literally shook my work up. And it became what's now called the shaky style. Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to go to Oberlin College, and what did you study there?
I studied history and English. Thank God I didn't study art.
Why is that?
Because I wasn't interested in art. Although that's very funny, what I can't figure out is that I did go to a special high school in New York, music and art. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why I applied to music and art. It must have been the influence of my neighbor.
Right.
Who, by the way, helped me with my portfolio, which didn't hurt.
Who was it?
God, her illustrations were fabulous. Her name, Maxa Nordau, Nordau. Not well known, but... And she was French, and she was blonde, and she was very attractive, and she was very bohemian. I mean, I remember that we were living on Central Park West at the time, mm-hmm. and she did murals of the park on the walls of her home. So when I would come to visit her, which was often, after all, she just lived the next door apartment, I was overwhelmed by her because where there was a light switch, she put the back of a donkey and she would occasionally ask me to turn on the light, which meant I had to go to the donkey's ass and turn the light on. And boy, for an adolescent, I mean, come on now. In any event, I think it was because of her that I thought, I'll apply to music and art.
Okay. After graduating from Oberlin, your first job was a piece for a magazine called Park East, for which you were paid $100. Do you remember that job?
Oh, yeah, sure.
How did you get that job?
Well, I showed the guy my political cartoons.
Which you had compiled at Oberlin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's possible. I mean, we're going so far back. My memory isn't that good. It's possible that at the time I had published the what's now a graphic novel, The Juggler of Our Lady. But I don't think so. I think that happened after I got my first job. But what I do remember was that I was so impressed that they were going to pay me $100 for my stuff.
Yeah.
That I then did all my drawings in a so-called stitch line technique,
right,
which was very popular at the period. Ben Shahn originated that. And it was quite common among illustrators. And I adopted that style adapted that style.
Did you ever did you ever meet Ben Shahn?
No, I never did. No.
Okay.
No.
Do you know, I did some research, and $100 in 1951, 52 is $970 today.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? Wow. That's amazing. Yeah.
You mentioned The Juggler of Our Lady. So it was a Christmas book. And how did they hook up with you? I mean, how did you hook up with them? Was it simply a matter, same thing, where you just show them your portfolio? Or were you starting to get more and more work?
Well, what happened is that at Oberlin, I took a seminar in humor, taught by, as a matter of fact, I later learned, an associate of Luis Buñuel, the great Mexican film director. Mm-hmm. That's irrelevant. What's relevant is that for a term project, I did a graphic novel based on a kind of history of Rome. What I recall was that I got the worst mark in the class, a B minus. Uh-huh. And the only other person in the seminar who got a bad mark, B minus being the lowest, was William Goldman, the screenwriter, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And we were the only two people who went on to careers in our respective fields. Isn't that thing? All the others who got B pluses and A's dropped out, and who knows what became of them. Sometimes early success can be disabling.
Yeah.
Okay, because you're in the outside world and it's a whole other scene there.
Right. Just a few years later, that book was so successful that it became a film. Animated by Al Kuzel and Gene Deitch.
Well, good for you for knowing that research. Yeah, they did a nice job. Yeah.
And Gene Deitch would later, just a couple years after that, would win an Academy Award for Monroe.
Yeah.
How did that, I mean, here's what I'm trying to get at. On paper, your first years as an illustrator did appear to be pretty successful. I suspect that there were some tough stretches, though, but maybe not.
Well, my only tough stretch was when I went to Europe for a few months on my honeymoon. And then when I came back after 3 or 4 months, no work at all. It was very difficult. I was out of the scene. And other people were being used because I wasn't around. So that was a very tough period for me.
Yeah.
But my ideas were very good. I think much better than at that time my drawings. Yeah. Came back in stride soon enough. But it was a little difficult being away from the New York scene. As a matter of fact, I think moving to the country 30 years ago or so didn't exactly help my career.
Really? You think so?
Oh, yeah. I think what happens, though, more than anything else, is when you're editors and art directors are replaced by new art directors and new editors that have to justify the move by introducing new people. Mm-hmm. And you're an old person, you know, you're the old look. So you find that, you know, you've lost them only because of the need of the new art directors to show something to justify their new positions. So that's always very tough. But I have to say, I miss advertising. I enjoyed the nonsense, and it paid very, very well, unlike illustration, which doesn't pay very well at all.
It still doesn't.
No, it still doesn't.
Illustrators are getting paid essentially the same fees today as they were 50 years ago, and everything else has changed, but not the fees.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for years I've been doing work for the New York Times Magazine. I do poetry spots. The fee is the same. I had to fight to get a little bit more than what they offered. But I'm very grateful for the fact that I have anything that is steady. Mm-hmm. Being a freelancer, you treasure the steady work. For me, that comes in weekly. So I can't complain, and I'm not complaining.
Before The Juggler of Our Lady, you were drafted into the Korean War.
Yeah. Fortunately, I was into Germany and not Korea, or I wouldn't be around on this interview if that were the case. I was very fortunate.
You were transferred to Asbury Park, New Jersey. Is that right?
That's right.
What were you doing there?
Can you believe well, actually, I was doing technical illustrations, and then when I was shipped to Germany, I was doing medical illustrations, if you can believe it. But there were a lot of German civilians who were hired by the army to work with us. Mm-hmm. And so what we lacked, they filled.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned advertising. You mentioned medicine. Let's take a 10-year leap forward. If anyone reads any two write-ups about you, a 1967 Alka-Seltzer commercial is mentioned. You anthropomorphized a stomach, and the stomach sits across this person, his person. Do you remember how that commercial came about? Was it just simply a matter of Alka-Seltzer calling you and saying, hey, can you do the creative for this ad?
The agency unfortunately doesn't get the proper credit for it, because the whole the concept was so brilliant that although it's become known as the Blechman commercial, hey, come on now. Yes, I visualized it, but people forget how extraordinary the concept was. What bothered the hell out of me was that I'm more known for that than for something I did in 1982, Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale.
I know, I saw that too.
And that was great. That was the highest moment in my animation career. Loved working on that. I didn't add much to it, except that I remember at the very end they wanted the stomach to shake hands with the person, and I said, no way, they're not going to shake hands, they're just going to pledge to work together. Mm-hmm. And you never know whether they're going to work together. That's real life.
That's right.
So that was my contribution to the concept, nothing more than that.
Why do you think that is, though? Why do you think that people know you more for that than so many other things that you've done?
You turned your television set on 1967, and you at one time or another got to see the Alka-Seltzer spot. That's all.
Right.
The Soldier's Tale only showed once. That was it. But the spot was shown hundreds of times.
There are so many other things I want to ask you about, including Simple Gifts, Soldier's Tale. But for sake of time, I want to shift gears just a little bit. And before I shift gears, I'm going to shift gears from shifting gears and ask you, was it with Simple Gifts that you worked with Seymour Quast, who, by the way, was on the podcast, and also Marie Sendak?
Yeah, and also don't forget James McMullen.
Oh, yeah.
He did a brilliant, brilliant job. Everybody came through wonderfully then, yeah.
McMullen's one of my personal favorite illustrators.
Oh, he's amazing.
He is so amazing.
He's an amazing artist. I think the best watercolorist in the country, period. Just
agreed.
Like DeMuth. What's his first name? Charles DeMuth? I can't remember his first name.
Do you remember working with Marie Sendak? And if so, what was he like?
Wow. Well, I think...
I mean, and you can say, by the way, you can say he was a son of a gun, and then we can just leave it at that and move on.
No. What I remember afterwards was that he wasn't sure about an illustration that he had done for a job. And he showed it to me. I said, "Hey, Maurice, that's great." And what I remember was that he came towards me and he hugged me. And he said, "Really?" He was so unsure of himself and of his work. That struck me pretty profoundly.
Yeah.
That he didn't know how great he was. Of course, this was what, 1970-something.
Mm-hmm.
But he already was an accomplished and recognized artist. Yet he didn't know how terrific he was. He needed confirmation from me. Oh, what happened with working with Maurice was that I saw a Christmas card of his, and I thought, maybe had two or three panels, four panels most. I said, "Hey, this make a great little film." And indeed it was, thanks as much to the film score and the animation as it was to this concept and the drawing.
Yep.
People really don't appreciate the role of the animator and the musician as much as they should. With the bird spot, the Christmas bird spot that I did for CBS. I didn't do it for CBS, I did it for myself, and then I rented it to CBS. Mm-hmm. That it was a perfectly brilliant score that so complemented and pushed the concept and the animation.
Here's the gear I want to shift into now.
Sure.
We talked a little bit about your, I hate this word so much, but style.
Yeah.
The squiggly line, the broken line. Stephen Heller described your process this way. He draws dozens of tiny squiggly lines on adhesive backed paper. Then he cuts it out with an X-Acto knife and pastes it onto the image. I guess my follow-up to that is, really? That's how you do it?
Well, that's how I did it.
That's how you did it? I mean, is it that labor-intensive, huh? I guess just by looking at it, you'd think that it's just simply a matter of lifting the pen off and on the page at choice moments. But it's more of a puzzling than simple line drawing.
I do a lot less of it than I had done. So what Stephen Heller described was the way I had worked, but that's not the case now.
What's the case now?
Well, the case now is if I don't like a drawing, I just do the whole damn thing over again. It's no big thing. Yeah, I mean, it's my hands are more able than they had been. Or maybe what it is, I'm surer of myself than I had been. I think that's the case. I think Maurice also was unbelievably very unsure of his work, Well, the guy wouldn't have hugged me when I told him that. That's really good.
Have you ever met any illustrator? Because I, you know, through discussions with illustrators through the illustration department and other conversations I've had, I have yet to have a conversation with any illustrator, regardless of their experience, who have been confident with what they do. I think isn't that just a natural part of being an illustrator, part of being an artist, is you're just not fully like pleased with what you're doing. I guess my question to you is, have you ever come across anyone who is confident with what they're doing and doesn't experience that sort of self-doubt that Sendak was experiencing?
I really don't know.
Okay.
Really valid question. I wish I could give a perfectly valid answer. I really don't know how my peers work.
Well, okay, let me reframe it this way. When did you feel like you were more confident with what you were doing?
Well, I look back at my early stuff and I don't like it. I mean, I look at The Juggler, for God's sakes, I was a 23-year-old. But the very crudity and honesty of the work transmitted itself. You know, you can always tell when something is honest or when it's dishonest. And my work, during its several periods, was always honest. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a piece of writing or a piece of music or a piece of, well, that's enough. the maker conveys the integrity or the lack of it, and that this communicates somehow to the listener, the viewer, the, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if this is true, but this is something that I've read. A high school art teacher said to you, look, I can't say anything good about you, and I won't say anything bad about you, so I won't say anything at all.
Well, that's true. But of course, this is junior high school.
Okay.
We had to come into the classroom with our Life magazines, our Look magazines, our Saturday Evening Posts, and we had to copy them. And that's what art was all about. If you copy them convincingly, then you must be an artist. But if you couldn't, then you couldn't possibly be an artist. So yeah, that was very true. I didn't get a recommendation, and she was nice enough not to say, "Hey, this guy can't make it. You know, he's no artist." Right. She's being generous to me.
I'm going to ask you to say something directly to the listeners of this podcast, many if not all of whom are illustrators, who are trying to figure out how they too can have a 60 plus year long creative career. So with that in mind, what would be your best piece of advice?
If you're offered the opportunity to do a job and the circumstances aren't what you would like, the pay isn't what it should be, the time frame isn't what it should be, you're aware of the negatives because they're so apparent, grab the job. Some of the best work I've done has been under the worst circumstances. I'll give you an example. A guy called me up who had just started a magazine, and he wanted me to give him something I had done, any piece of art that I had done that I think was appropriate for a cover. And he would pay me $100. I thought to myself, who the hell needs $100? I mean, it wasn't so long ago that $100 was the equivalent of a few hundred or a thousand. But I love the idea of doing a cover. I love the idea of doing design work. So I said, no, I'll do something original. I won't give you anything that I had done. And that turned into a 20-year series of doing work for the magazine, doing all the covers. And it was the best job other than the film work that I had done, that I had ever received. And if I had been practical, I would have said, well, can you make it 150? Can you make it 200? No. I wanted very much to do that job. I took the guy at his word with the limitations were there, and I never regretted it. Maybe this is relevant, maybe not, I don't know. I was once asked if I knew the cartoonist Hirschfeld. And the person who asked me, I responded, yeah, I know the guy. I met him once or twice. Would you ask him if he would do a drawing for my agency, giving us permission to use something he had done? So I called Hirschfeld up, and I said, I was asked to speak to you about whether you would give this agency a drawing that you had done already, and they would pay X amount. And Hirschfeld said, oh, hell no, I'll do an original. He didn't want to give them something that he had done. So I think if you have the opportunity to do artwork, do it.
I have one more question.
Please.
You've been in illustration since the early 50s. It is now almost 70 years later. Do you have any thoughts on where illustration is going?
Wow. Up.
To learn more about Bleckman, visit robleckman.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you'll receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, and access to patron-only episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our new forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.